beneath all the daily desires and aspirations and worries and perceived necessities, what's the thing that we're most deeply craving down in our bones? This is a question I've been contemplating the last couple weeks, and it's a question that I've been engaging explicitly with our beloved rector, Jimmy Bartz, over the last couple months with respect to young people in our community. For the last few months, Jimmy and I have been engaged in an intentional process of revisioning and reimagining our approach to youth ministry at St. John's Episcopal Church. We've been asking this question: what do human beings crave most deeply, and what do our young people most deeply need? If we want to be part of an approach to supporting whole person student wellness, to supporting students' physical, mental, and spiritual and emotional health, what could St. John's Episcopal Church be doing that perhaps teachers and other educators and parents and mentors aren't able to do? It's interesting, we've been meeting every Monday for about an hour, and I tend to go straight to programming. I'll try to get visionary and innovative and say, well, Jimmy, what if we do a service project and bring food and catering to the kings and queens of Corbett's athletes? Or what if we take a group of young people to Teton Valley Ranch Camp over the summer for a transformative rite of passage experience? We're going to do both of those, by the way. But what Jimmy keeps saying is, Travis, you're getting ahead of us. You're jumping to programming when I want to be at philosophy and ethos. You're already at the what, and I want to get to the why. What are we trying to provide students? What are we as human beings most deeply needing? As we've contemplated this question, our reflections continue to circle back to the work of social scientist Brené Brown. Some of y'all may know Dr. Brown's work. She's a professor of social work at the University of Houston, and she sort of went viral in 2013 when she gave a TED Talk called The Power of Vulnerability. I highly commend it. It's still ranked in the top 5 most viewed TED Talks of all times. And Dr. Brown is a vulnerability expert. She talks about the benefits of showing up in difficult situations courageously in such a way that we allow ourselves to truly be seen. But she sort of came at vulnerability in an oblique way because she started out as a shame researcher. And she kind of jokes about the fact that anytime she wanted to make sure she had an entire airline flight to herself to focus on a book or a movie she wanted to watch, she's a big Downton Abbey fan, she would say all she had to do was say to the person next to her in response to that perennial question, "What do you do for a living?" She'd say, "Oh, me? I research shame." And immediately that person would recoil and give her all the space she wanted, because shame is something that terrifies us as a culture. And she thinks that it is pandemic in American society in particular as a corrosive force to all of our collective psycho-emotional well-being. I've mentioned this in sermons in the past, but there's a difference between shame and guilt as she defines it. She says guilt is the feeling that I did something wrong. I did something wrong, I left something done or undone, and it can actually be a positive motivator in correcting our behavior. But shame is the feeling not that I did something wrong, but I am something wrong. There's something deep down amiss with me which needs fixing. And I have to earn my way back into some state of approval or health or stability or acceptance. And Brené Brown says that vulnerability and empathy are like antidote to shame. That if you put shame in a petri dish and douse it with a little empathy, with the little fellow feeling, it can't survive. And the same with vulnerability, that if we want to be wholehearted people and banish the shame gremlins, we cultivate this ability to show up courageously and imperfectly and let ourselves be seen. And in a lot of ways, all of her teaching distills down to a single sentence, which Jimmy and I just keep contemplating in this question of what we're trying to provide young people, and in turn, what we're trying to provide all of you. Brené Brown says that we human beings are hardwired for struggle, but we're also worthy of love and belonging. That struggle is an inevitable part of human life, pain and difficulty. But where the story begins is our innate worthiness of love and belonging. And if I'm honest with myself, that assurance of worthiness, of the fact that we are worthy of love and belonging, not because of anything we do, but just by virtue of the fact that we are born and exist as members of this one human family, that's what I want young people to know deep in their bones, in every fiber of their being. It's what I want my 3-year-old daughter to know as she navigates life, and it's what I want to know for myself deep down inside. This fall, many of you know my wild, unbridled, exuberant 3-year-old daughter, Helen. She's not here today. She's taking her first day of ski school lessons, which I'm really psyched about. But Helen is a force of nature. And this fall, for some reason, my beloved wife, Gracie, thought that she was old enough to participate in team sports for the first time. I thought 3 was maybe a little bit early, but nevertheless, I signed on. She was drafted to a soccer team, the Jackson Hole Beavers, and my wife made these beautiful little felt beaver tails that she adorned with sort of glitter glue cross hatching, and the kids would sport for all their games, and somehow I got wrangled into acting as coach, which is like a term I would use very loosely. I mean, to say that this was herding cats was such an understatement. It would be like following these kids down the field, this little herd of 3 and 4-year-olds, and just saying, kick it into that goal right there, not that one, that one. And if someone takes the ball from you, you can take it back. And truth be told, I had a hard time even getting my daughter onto the pitch. Most of the time, she wanted to spend her energy playing on the sidelines with the other coach's daughter, Elise. And it was always a belabored process of wrangling them together and trying to get them to the end of the cars at the end of practice. And one day, this is probably the most memorable moment I have from the entire season. Helen and Elise were doing their little exuberant, chaotic thing, playing around on a sort of miniature little soccer goal. And I went over to them. They asked me to lift them up so they could hang on the goalpost. And Elise, like, her parents must have like already lived in Jackson for a decade or so, because this kid has that like preternatural Jackson skill when it comes to extreme sport activities. I lifted Elise up, and I kid you not, she started doing like Ninja Warrior style pull-ups on the goalpost. I lifted Helen up, and she's barely holding on by her 10 little fingertips, but she was laughing the entire time. And for the first time as a father, I realized, oh, there are going to be situations that Helen will enter, and she won't be as capable as some of the other kids around her. There are going to be situations in which other kids are better, more have more ability in any given context, and there's nothing I can do to protect her or shield her from that experience of being less than. I can't remove from her life that fact that she's wired for struggle, but what I can do is instill in her that deep sense that no matter what, she's worthy of love and belonging. Of course, that experience sort of triggered my own memories of childhood trauma around team sports as well. In particular, when I moved from Houston, Texas to Atlanta, Georgia in 1996 and tried out for Little League Baseball. And as a 12 or 13-year-old in Atlanta, Georgia in 1996, being on a Major League Little League Baseball team was like the most important thing in the world. All the kids on those Little League baseball teams got these shiny starter jackets that they'd sport around school, looking ever so cool. And I remember showing up into this context where kids have had batting coaches since age 5. I'm coming from church league, T-ball. And my father, who's a man of modest stature like I am, told me, you know, Travis, he's got a really thick Texas accent. He said, Travis, we Helms, we've never been the biggest or the strongest or the fastest, but by golly, we hustle. And I remember getting up for that Little League tryout, probably missing most of my pitches, but then running it out to first base. And one of the coaches even exclaiming, who's that kid? And my dad saying, that's Travis Helms, the new kid from Houston, Texas. Well, Travis Helms, the new kid from Houston, Texas, did not get drafted to a team. And I learned later on in high school that the commissioner of that Little League, and y'all, this is like some heart-wrenching, cruel stuff, came home and asked his son, hey, what do you think about this kid, Travis Helms? Should he be drafted? He said, no, Dad, don't draft him. He's a loser. I swear I've gotten over this. I'm like, why am I having to tell this story in public again? But that feeling of trauma, of shame, instilled in me this deep sense of like somehow I didn't fit in. Somehow I wasn't worthy enough. And looking back on it, it also gave me an experience of what true, authentic belonging and welcome didn't feel like. Because the fact is, as communities, we can be pretty vicious with one another. We can be pretty mean and pretty shaming, especially in a culture that's so hyper-competitive, that's so rampant with this desire to compare ourselves to others in order to feel worthy. But there's a different type of belonging that I believe we are all meant to feel and live into and live from deep down. And we get a picture of it in our gospel reading for today. We've got a story in Luke's gospel that shows Jesus coming into his own as an individual and within the context of community. A few weeks ago, I joked about this kind of thing that Jimmy's mentioned as well, that Mark is kind of the Hemingway of the gospel writers and Luke is the Faulkner, and he tells these vivid, intensely intimate stories that give us such a clear sense of what it would have been like for Jesus to navigate the world as a human. And this is kind of like a continuation of his nativity narrative, but now we see Jesus as a young man, as an adolescent, as a 12-year-old finding his way into Jewish society. And he goes to the Passover feast in Jerusalem with his family. And for Jewish people, the Passover feast was the highest of holy days. It was a commemoration of this act of liberation when the Israelite people are set free from bondage in Egypt and they pass over the Red Sea and go into the wilderness. And there was actually a law that required every Jewish person within 15 miles of Jerusalem to make a pilgrimage to that city in order to celebrate the Passover. And even for those living a bit further afield, there was sort of a goal to at least make one Passover in Jerusalem over the course of your life, sort of the way that most Muslims try to make a Hajj pilgrimage to Mecca. Moreover, at the age 12, a Jewish boy became a man in the eyes of society. So this is like Jesus's rite of passage, his debut as a young man in Jerusalem. And we have to imagine that the Passover feast would have totally overawed him. Something in his heart must have been kindled by the beauty of the pageantry, by that collective buzz and foment of celebration. We're not really given a description of the festival itself, but we have this episode of his family's journey back to Galilee. And it's curious. It's perplexing and a little bit comical. What we're told is the caravan travels about a day, and then all of a sudden, Mary and Joseph can't find Jesus. And as like 21st century folks hearing this story, we're like, what negligent parents? Like, what is up with Mary and Joseph? How did they not miss the fact that there's this like wonder kid is not with them as they're traveling back home? But the norms in those days were a little bit different. What would happen is that typically the women and the children would start out early in the morning on any sort of a long voyage. The men would hang back, tend to whatever business they had to tend to. Then they'd catch up at the camp by nightfall. So we can imagine that Joseph, with the other young men, maybe Jesus would have been a part of that, shows up and Mary's like, wait, Joseph, where's Jesus? I mean, he's 12 now. Isn't he traveling with the men? And that Joseph is like, whoa, you know what? I kind of forgot. I thought he'd be with the women and children. And it was just a little bit of a communication breakdown. But they're terrified. They go back to Jerusalem. And I mean, every parent knows that anxiety. Like, Helen is pretty free range on this campus. She's kind of like the queen of St. John's. And in Hanson Hall for coffee hour, she's usually just roaming all over the place. And if I get caught talking with someone, I just trust that like Ann or Benny or Lonnie or like someone probably has eyes on her, so I don't get too anxious. But every now and again, if I like for a couple minutes can't find her, I get absolutely terrified. Mary and Joseph look for Jesus for 3 days. I can't imagine that panic, that anxiety, that terror. And then they find him and he's just hanging out with all the rabbis. And we've got this kind of like image in our head that's maybe a little bit romanticized of like Jesus, this young prodigy, discoursing with the religious leaders. And maybe he's even like out debating them because he's so precocious. But actually, this was something that happened pretty frequently. After the Passover, every year it was common for the Sanhedrin, the kind of like chief priests, to sit around having a public debate. And we're told that Jesus is listening and asking questions. And the real language there Luke uses is like, he's just being a good student. He's just hanging around asking questions, and he's listening and he's learning. But his parents are terrified and furious, and they say, Jesus, why have you treated us this way? And his response is so beautiful. He says, hey, didn't you know that I would be here in my Father's house? Didn't you know I would be here in my Father's house? And I think we hear that as Jesus like doing a little bit of a ranking. He's saying like, yeah, Mary, Joseph, y'all been good to me, but like actually I'm the son of the Most High, living and almighty God. So like this is where I would rather be. But Jesus isn't saying that. We're told in the next verse that he goes back to Galilee and is obedient to them. So he knows that he's part of a family. He's part of this cultural unit. He accepts that as part of what it means to be living as a human being. But he also knows there's this other thing going on. There's another reality he's tapped into. Hanging out with these rabbis, being in the temple, he has gotten in touch with the fact that he is a beloved child of God, and that this space is his space, just as it is each and every one of your space. There's this beautiful passage in John's gospel where he says, in John chapter 1, where the writer says, for all who believed in Jesus, the cosmic Christ, gave he power to be sons and daughters of God. Every one of us stands next to Jesus as a fellow sibling. Every one of us is a beloved child of God, and it's always been part of our sacred story. Just as Brené Brown says, we're wired for struggle, but worthy of love and belonging. In Genesis, it says that we toil and work the ground with the sweat of our brow, but we are made in God's image, beautiful and radiant and very good, is what God pronounces when he sees human creatures. Very good is where we start from. And yes, should we not all be here in our Father's house? When I hear Jesus's tone, I hear someone who is discovering a truth that he just assumes everyone else already knows. Y'all, shouldn't I be here in my Father's house? This is a place where we should all belong, where we should all feel welcome as children of the living God. And that tone always reminds me of an experience I had as a young man preparing for seminary. I was living in Houston, Texas, and hanging out with priests, trying to learn as much as I could about ministry. And there was one mentor of mine, a guy named John Price, who was a priest for many years, and he served as a chaplain at Fort Hood Military Base. And John Price interviewed, over the course of his career, 200 people who experienced near-death experiences. And what he says, he wrote a book about his experience interviewing these folks, and he says there are common elements to all the near-death experiences. Everyone who had this experience experienced a sense of kind of disassociating from their body and then going down a tunnel toward a bright light. When they get to the end of the light, there's some celestial being that greets them. It could be an angel or a loved one who's departed or someone from a spiritual tradition like Jesus or the Virgin Mary or the Buddha. And then they have a sort of end of life review before entering into their bliss. And there's one story that always sticks out for me. There was a gentleman who had this experience, and he finds himself on the gates of heaven discoursing with an angel, and he looks to his periphery. Something catches his eye, and it's a group of figures sort of shrouded in shadow, huddled together in the darkness. And the man asks the angel, "Angel, what about these folks? Why can't these folks come in?" And the angel says, "Oh, these folks, of course they can come in. Everyone can come in. Of course they can come in. They just don't think they can. They just don't think they can." It's that same tone. Of course they can come in. Of course I would be here in my Father's house. All of us, of course, we're children of the divine. All of us are worthy of love and belonging. Sometimes we just don't think we are. What Brené Brown says we have to do to get rid of the shame that blocks us from that feeling of being truly included and welcomed is to practice different things. She says, "Hey, I really wish this was just like a knowledge set that you could take on and instantly become a more wholehearted person. But if we want to live out of the sense of our belovedness, that we are worthy of love and belonging, there are certain things we have to practice." And she says that gratitude is one of the most important ones. And so maybe my invitation to you all would be, as we start this new season of Epiphany, maybe you start your day before you get out of bed just naming three things you're grateful for. Maybe you journal a little bit over your morning coffee, 5, 10 new things each day that you want to give thanks for. Maybe you set an alarm on your phone for noon, and at your lunch hour, you just name one thing you're thankful for. Because the heart can't hold fear and gratitude at once. And if we want to have this experience that we are worthy of love and belonging, we have to practice that as well. I've got to say that as being a priest in this church, one of my favorite experiences is when that little girl, Helen, comes in for communion and approaches the altar rail. She's kind of gotten a little more restrained these days, but when she was about 2, she would come down the aisle with my wife, Gracie, and she would see me arrayed in all my fancy robes up here and exclaim, "Dada!" And it was just sheer joy and would melt my heart every time. What I didn't know until a few weeks ago, until my wife Gracie told me, is that every time she would go to get her from Children's Chapel to bring her into communion, she'd say, "Hey, Helen, you want to come into communion?" And Helen would say, "Yeah, Mama, I want to come to come on in. I want to come to come on in." That's what she heard when she heard that word communion. Come on in. She's the most brilliant theologian in our family. Because that's what this is all about. This place of love, this house of the living God, is a place where all of you belong. Each and every one of you, beloved, created in God's image, are worthy of love, acceptance, and belonging. Hear that. Feel that. Practice that. Come on in, y'all. Come on in. Amen.